come to order. Welcome everyone to the Capitol. For some of you, this is a return visit. For some of you, this may be your first time. I wanted to give a couple of prefacing remarks for what we're doing here today and how it fits in to the work that we're doing overall. We are in the midst of a very careful discussion this week about special education services and a variety of ways that we serve students with special needs across the state. On Monday, this committee, instead of meeting in this committee room, went over and visited and spent a couple of hours at the Oregon School for the Blind to learn more about the students and the programs that are offered there. On Wednesday, we had an informational hearing related to the Oregon School for the Blind for the purposes of beginning a discussion about the question of moving forward, whether the legislature should support the co-location of the School for the Blind with the School for the Deaf, as has been determined by the Superintendent of Public Education, who has the authority to make that co-location. That is not a decision for the legislature, or to close the School for the Blind. And we heard 5 or 6 hours of testimony in total on Wednesday. Today we are focused on early intervention and early childhood special education programs for children with all kinds of disabilities in the state of Oregon, and then also an informational hearing on the services to children with visual impairments in regional programs and public school districts throughout the state. An informational hearing, generally we have invited testimony, so we have panels of people who are coming to educate the committee to help us better understand what these services are and what they're about. I understand that there are some individuals who have come to talk about the ways that regional programs are not working for your students who are at the School for the Blind currently. And there will be, and I'm concerned we're going to run out of time before the end of this hearing to get to you, but if you make sure we have your contact information, I assure you we will be having more meetings on this issue, and everyone that wants to be heard in this process will be heard, even if it's not today. And then finally, I wanted to make a clarifying comment for those that are in the room, those that may be listening on the internet or watching on television. I've received a number of emails and phone calls from individuals at the School for the Blind who noted a bill that was introduced with my name on it on Wednesday, which created a task force to study the challenges and opportunities at the Oregon School for the Blind, and many of those letters were thank you notes for being responsive to the testimony on Wednesday. And while the testimony on Wednesday was compelling, that bill was introduced earlier, and that's one piece of the discussion about where we might go for the School for the Blind. We are continuing that conversation about the potential closure of the School for the Blind, even though that's not what we're talking about today. So with that, are there questions from the committee? Wonderful. And my thanks again to the committee for your patience the other evening, for staying to be sure that everyone that wanted to be heard could be heard. I got many positive comments from many people about the attentiveness and the depth of questions from the committee.
Just so you know, Chair, yours was short. Last night we had an Ag and Natural Resource one that started at 5:30 and got over at 9:10.
Thank you, Representative Roblin. I feel better now. So, because we have two panels, we've got 16 people we're going to hear from today. We are going to adjourn at 5 minutes until 3. So I know that the panels have come prepared to limit their comments so that we can get through it. I am asking all of us to do our part in assisting that to take place as we consider the length and the depth of our questions. And of course, if there's more questions later, we can follow up. Yes.
Madam Chair, you can feel free to call me out. I understand. Huffman?
No, Representative Huffman, I know I owe you a diet soda and a cookie, so I tread lightly. Representative Roblin, sending you chocolate. All right, with that, I am going to open the informational hearing on early intervention in early childhood special education services, and I would invite Judy Newman.
We need to keep it clean.
And for those of you that are here, there is a lot going on in the building today. And so as people come and go, it's not because you have said something that's
Thank
made
you.
Someone run away.
Thank you for saying that. Are you ready for me?
Yeah, oh, yes,
okay,
please,
great.
Please. And as you know the drill,
great.
State
okay.
your name. And
My name is Judy Newman, and I'm from Lane County. I'm a contractor of early intervention, early childhood special ed services, and also on the State Early Intervention Coordinating Council. And I'd like to address Representative Chairperson Gelser and members of the committee. And first, I just want to start by thanking you. This is my job today is to give you an overview, so I am going to talk a little longer than some of the testimony to give you an idea of what these services are about. And this is my very favorite topic, and I can talk fast. So what you have in front of you is a PowerPoint. I decided not to show it for the sake of time, and but you could follow along, and I'm obviously not going to read every slide. So, but hopefully it'll be good reference material. So the first question, of course, is what is early intervention, early childhood special education? And the simple answer that I give most people is that it's special education for children birth to five. It's mandated in federal law under IDEA, which is the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, since 1986, and it's been mandated in Oregon since 1992 in Oregon statute. So what does a mandated entitlement service mean? Well, according to federal and state law, all eligible children are entitled to receive necessary special education services so they make adequate progress. And I bolded some of those points. Adequate progress is really what we are charged to do for every child that we find. The other thing that an entitlement program says is that we aren't allowed to have any wait lists, and services must be provided in a timely manner. And there's a pretty quick timeline. We have 45 days for the little ones and 60 days for the older ones to actually make sure they're eligible and provide the services. So that's pretty quick, and no wait lists. Parents also have legal due process rights and options under the law. And so in early intervention programs, the Oregon Department of Ed and programs, our programs that provide the services, can be vulnerable to lawsuits if we aren't doing our job. So how is this program funded? Well, we're funded in three ways. The majority of the funds come from our Oregon taxpayers under the general fund, and it's in the grant and aid budget in education, and you guys have something to say about that. The other part, about 21%, comes from federal IDEA funds, and that's special education. And then there's some funding that comes from Medicaid. The legislature has required our programs to bill Medicaid. And it used to be that we got about 2% of our funding, and now it really has been reduced to less than 1% because of changes in Medicaid definitions and how you can bill. So on the next page, 5, 6, and 7, I've listed all the service areas in Oregon. Just know that in every single county of Oregon, kids get these services. So I hope all of you know some families in your community that actually get early intervention and early childhood special ed services. If you don't, you probably will meet some this session, I hope. And I've put the numbers of kids served in the counties that each one of the 9 service areas through the ESDs throughout Oregon, where those counties get their services. At the very end of this, I wanted to just say that as of February 1st of this year, are serving 9,493 children statewide, and that's a 4.8% increase over last February. So our numbers are growing, and the graph at the bottom on the slide 8 gives you a pretty good visual representation of the last, 5 years of growth. So what does early intervention do? Well, early intervention is the part of the law, the services that provide educational services to kids birth through age 2. And those are we provide services to kids with identified disabilities or developmental delays or with risk factors that are highly likely to result in a disability. And so, for example, if a child is born with Down syndrome, they may not show up immediately, right away delayed. But we can provide services because we are quite sure that that child will have some developmental delays as they grow. What does early childhood special ed do? Well, that is part of the program that provides educational services to kids 3 to 5, and those are kids with disabilities, developmental delays, or sensory impairments. So, description of the programs. In early intervention, we focus, I'm on slide 11, we focus really on working with families and primary caregivers. We do parent coaching, parent training. We serve kids in their natural environments. And we feel this is so, so critical because you know that parents are with the kids all the time. And professionals coming into your home, it's such a small fraction of the time that they're with their children compared to families. So really the best investment we can make is working with families. And also families obviously have the kids for their lifespan. So the more we can provide them skills and supports and training early on, the better off we think we are. For early childhood special ed, when the kids turn 3, we start doing a little more educational skill-building kinds of programs, and we're charged to serve kids with typical peers as much as possible, but we never lose the focus on including families. You know, families are still primary, obviously, from birth to 5, so we still do a lot with families then. The next couple slides, I'm not going to go into detail, but the point I want to make about these is that Oregon's early intervention and early childhood special education eligibility criteria is considered among the most restrictive in the nation. The federal government has categorized the eligibility that every state decides to use in 3 categories, and we are in the category of the most restrictive. So I think we are serving the right kids. And the other thing I want to say is if you read for yourself slide 12 and 13, it tells exactly what we have to prove to make kids eligible. And there's a pretty rigorous eligibility process with standardized testing. And so I guess we want to just assure you that we think we're getting the right children. In Oregon, 14, I'd be
Madam
remiss
Chair?
Not
yes.
to mention.
It's specifically on that point, because I've asked the question locally, the cost of assessment is not cheap, correct?
Correct, yes.
And so are we spending more in assessment than we are in treatment?
No. Oh, I can definitely say that is not true.
Okay.
And when I talk about the process, we do a very low-cost developmental evidence-based screening for most kids when we get a referral. So we know when we move them on to a full-fledged assessment that we're getting the right kids.
Thank you.
So... thank you.
Thank you, Judy.
Seamless system. Oregon has taken the position, it's a very strong value in our state, that we make this one program. In many states around the country, you see the 0 to 3 kids served one way and the 3 to 5s another way. We've made it a seamless system because we've listened to families. And what that does is make the program one program from 0 to 5. And so it minimizes the cost and the effort we have to do when kids turn 3, and it also makes it much less disruptive for kids and families. So we really feel good about it. We know actually other states and the federal government is looking at our model thinking it's working pretty well here, so we might see some changes federally. On slide 15, it lists how we serve children, and really I just want to say we individualize services. Kids are served on home visits, they're served in parent-toddler classrooms, they're served in specialized classrooms, they're served in community preschools with supports. We run some of our own preschools but enroll typical peers and charge tuition in communities where there aren't other preschool options. So there are many ways, and we really try to individualize for each child. The next slide talks about what kind of professionals actually work with the children. And I would say that our workforce is very highly professional. It's the same kind of workforce that you'd see in schools and special education, the early childhood special educators, speech and language pathologists, deaf and hard of hearing specialists, occupational physical therapists. The list is long. But they also have to have the specialty of knowing how to work with little ones and work with families. So they not only have their professional specialty, they really want to work with little kids and families. So the next slide talks about the process, and I think I touched on that with Representative Maurer's question, that we get, anyone can make a referral. You can call up. The early intervention programs are a central point of referral in all these counties. And then we usually do a developmental screening. Again, it's a family-friendly screen. It's evidence-based. And if the child shows, like, yes, it's a good referral, we'll move on to do an in-depth assessment, a developmental assessment, identify goals and see if they're eligible based on the assessment, identify goals and objectives and services, and then place them and match the right services to the kids' needs. And who refers kids? Well, the state tracks our referral sources, and I listed really the top six or seven, but we really get referrals from everywhere. Parents are the top people that refer to us. Physicians refer to us, Head Start teachers, community preschool providers, and DHS child welfare. We also get lots of referrals from Healthy Start and Department of Human Services. The last point on that slide says that talks about private therapies. You know, we do have families that could have the resources to go out and purchase services if they could. But the sad thing is, in most of our communities in Oregon, you couldn't even go out and buy them because they don't exist. Or they're very limited if they do exist. So we are sort of the only act in town for most families. Current trends and challenges. I'm on to slide 19. And I just want to say there's no income requirement. This is a free program, and it's available to any family who has a child that is eligible for services. But what we find is that a lot of our families are really struggling, and more families. And we know this because we have to bill Medicaid, and so we know that about half of our families are eligible for the Oregon Health Plan. And that number seems to go up and down, and we see it going up right now. About 10 to 13% of the children are living in foster care, so they've experienced some kind of trauma in their life, likely. 8 to 10% of the kids we have right now are eligible, have autism. So about 10% of the kids we serve have autism, and that number's going up. We're seeing increases in the children with multiple disabilities and medical needs, and increases in kids with behavior and social-emotional needs. So on the next slide, the numbers of eligible children, as you saw in the graph, are growing. We're 4.8% up from last year, and we still expect to see growth because Oregon's percentage of eligible children is still below the national projection. So we anticipate still seeing some growth. The next point I want to make is that resources and service levels haven't kept up with the numbers and needs of kids. And cuts in other services that serve our kids and families really put more pressure on the services we provide. We've recently done a study, the Oregon Department of Ed, and where we took a statewide sample of 200 individual plans that of early intervention from 2004 and 200 IFSPs from 2008, looking at both early intervention and early childhood special education kids. And we looked at their cover sheets, and we added up the services they were getting in 2004 and 2008. And the results show that in early intervention, there's been a 48.3% reduction in services. That's just in 4 years. And in early childhood special education, there's been an average of 20.1% reduction in services from 2004 to 2008. So this serious reduction in service levels in just 4 years has us concerned, and we're worried because we really want to do our job, which is make sure we can serve kids and make sure they make adequate progress. But we do feel vulnerable to lawsuits and to the worst case scenarios, not meeting kids' needs. So.
Judy, yes. I just feel compelled to jump in there. When I saw the number, the 48.3% decline from 04 to 08, that was stunning to me, not just because a 48.3% drop in service is alarming. That's from 2004. I experienced this program with my son in the mid-90s, and seeing the reduction that took place between 94 and 2000, which had to be at least equal to that, has really left us with a paucity of services available to some of our most needy young kids, where we can have parts of the state where a child with Down syndrome may be lucky to get an hour of service a month that's an infant or a toddler that's needing those services to learn to walk, to learn to talk, and in some cases even to learn to swallow so that they can eat orally instead of with a feeding tube. So these are just absolutely critical services that are really in need of our help.
Yeah. Thank you. So the next two slides I have to insert because I just like to remind people of the importance of starting early. It really, really makes sense. And, you know, I highlighted three main reasons. Obviously, brain development, first three years of life, 90% of brain cells grow. Reduction or elimination of future problems by starting early because you have such a plastic brain to work with. And our economists in the United States have reminded us this is the very best possible investment. For every dollar we spend, we can get a $4 to $17 return. And then the last graph, I think, is really stark because it's summarized, slide 24. If you look at the graph that goes up, it shows brain development, and the other graph that shows public funding. So you can see we spend the least amount of public dollars on kids at the time where their brains are developing the most rapidly. That slide really sort of summarizes it to me. Okay, slide 25. I'm trying to go really fast, so I hope
you're doing a good job.
Okay. So I was asked to just touch on the community collaborations because I know you hear about lots of programs out there for kids. And I listed some of these, and what I want to say about those is it's really critical. Early intervention, early childhood special ed has been around a long time in this state, and we work very, very closely with these partners. And that collaborative working is essential because that's really what stretches scarce resources. There isn't duplication. When people know about partners, you work together, and people that do one job do that well, so we can do our job well, which is provide the educational services. In the federal law, I just wanted to also mention we're focusing on three very special populations, and one is the homeless children and families. Another are children who have experienced abuse and neglect, and we have to really do a screening on all kids that are placed in foster care. And then the Carley's Law has made us partners in multidisciplinary teams with children that are in our services that are experiencing really difficult, you know, abuse and neglect situations. Drug and alcohol affected children are another group of kids we've been serving more and more. So if you turn the page, you'll see these little circles because Representative Gelser asked me to just maybe use the Head Start Oregon pre-kindergarten program and our program as an example of how we work together because sometimes people get us confused. So we have one circle that represents the early intervention, early childhood special ed programs, another circle, the Head Start Oregon pre-kindergarten programs in Oregon, and you see a little place where we go overlap. And so in our programs, we have about 10 to 20% of kids that we share, we both serve. But I'll tell you, it is really the best way to maximize resources because their job is to serve kids that are in poverty and to provide an educational service and medical and all those ancillary services. Our job is to serve the kids with disabilities. Head Start is charged to have 10% of kids with special needs. We come into their programs where these kids are getting a preschool, and we provide the specialized services. They don't have to pay for them out of their budgets. We don't have to pay for a preschool out of ours, and so it really works well. We're able to maximize our resources for those 10 to 20% kids. And if you read all the little bullets, you can see what they do, what we do, and what we share. Okay. We also get asked a lot, are we measuring outcomes for this program? And the federal government has a new requirement as of about a year and a half ago, or 2 years now, and they're asking us to figure out how to measure and report to them on these three outcome measures. One is how are kids doing in their positive social-emotional skills? How are the kids doing that we serve in their acquisition and use of knowledge and skills like early literacy? And the third is, are kids using appropriate behaviors to meet their needs? Are they able to really meet their needs, to communicate well? And we're looking at these three outcomes, and we have to then, if you go to the next slide at the top, we have to say about each one of these outcomes, rate our children about how they're doing compared to their typical peers. So, we are in the process of collecting baseline data on this, and I hope within a year we're going to have really good information to share with you. Currently, we're using a curriculum-based assessment that's evidence-based on all children. And what we're really proud of is that this curriculum-based assessment is a fabulous tool. It assesses kids in all developmental areas, and it can be used to set goals. It can be used to track individual progress of kids, and we can use it now to report outcomes to the federal government and hopefully to you by next year. So that's what we're looking at outcomes. And slide 31 talks about another question we get is, what about our kids when they go to school? Are they ready to learn? And I like to respond to this because I actually feel like our kids are even more ready to learn because they've had some intervention before this. All of our kids, first of all, are screened for their vision, hearing, and health. So if there's any issue, it's caught early and it's worked with, and any future issues would be minimized. Some children do enter kindergarten not needing any kind of service, not needing special education, not needing any supports. We don't have statewide data yet, but I know from my program in Lane County, we've been tracking this now for about 6 or 7 years, and 14 to 21% of our kids go to kindergarten not needing services. So I'm assuming we're somewhat indicative of the state, but we will find out as we collect statewide data. And then children who do need special education show up day one with a plan in place, with an eligibility in place, and with information about this strategy works, this is what works with my child, and so the new teachers don't have to start figuring out how to work with them. And so kids often need less services when they go to school, and over half of the kids, at least in my area, go to a regular kindergarten and get supports there. So, in many cases, as I said, they're more ready when they show up for school. So that is the end. I wanted to thank you so much and ask if anyone has any questions.
Are there any questions for Representative Kopp?
Thank you, Chair, and my apologies for being tardy. I was curious about how you're accumulating your data, because I know that the department has done an incredible job over the past few years since No Child Left Behind, not saying they did before that, but of creating a database for children and students. Is that in collaboration with the Department of Human Services? Because I have recently learned that the DHS wants to create a kids first database, and it's like, well, this sounds familiar. So any background that you have on that would be helpful.
Representative Comp, members of the committee, the data for the outcomes that we have to report to the federal government is collected. The Department of Ed actually has contracted with an organization to collect all the data and make the report. And so there is a centralized statewide database for all this. It is not connected with the Department of Human Service database. I know there have been conversations about sharing data. I don't know where they are.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions for Judy? No, Representative Kopp? I'm Representative Rivlin.
Same, it's kind of.
Yeah.
I just want to say thank you for being here. I do have part of Lane County, and I have visited both in Eugene and in the facilities they have in Florence, which are pretty amazing to watch the interactions of the different groups working together. And it's a pretty amazing thing to watch these kids. And the other group that was, she did not mention that I think, and in Lane County, it's a pretty high percentage, is our autistic kids. And the sooner we start dealing with those issues, like you mentioned before, the better chance we have of having them enter into public education later and be able to take advantage of it. And every year we lose makes it much more difficult.
Thank you, Representative. You're right. Thank you. And about 10% of our kids are eligible for early intervention, early childhood special ed under the category of autism. So that's a good amount. Yeah.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for your presentation and for all your work. Judy is just a long-standing champion for young children in the state of Oregon.
Yep. I've been saying I'm old.
I don't know that that's it. All right. I also just wanted to indicate how wonderful it is to hear the sounds of children in this room. It's thus far, that's made this one of the best parts of my day. So thanks for bringing your kids. And I hope you feel very comfortable having them in this room and allowing them to be children. Austin Hoppy, Christy Reese, and Whitney Trost.
Yeah.
And the way that this works, when you come up, even though I know your name, the tape recorder doesn't. So before you make your initial comments, just state your name for the record and then proceed with your comments.
You should tell them as much as the tape recorder.
And you're being broadcast all across the state on the internet. And if you want to, you can go home tonight and listen to yourself on the recording. We're not supposed to tell people that, Representative.
I didn't say
talk
anything.
Talk about pressure.
I didn't say anything. I just mentioned you could tell them about it.
My name is Austin Hoppe. I live in Polk County. And Madam Chair, Committee, thank you for this opportunity for me to be here to share our story. My wife and I have four children. Our youngest is Charlie, and he was born in 2006, and he has cerebral palsy and seizure disorder. And we, going into this with this fourth child on the way, we thought, we've got it made. We've done it three times over, and when Charlie showed up, everything was turned upside down, and everything that we had learned really wasn't as applicable as we had thought. And things got very dark with the number of seizures he was having. It was up to 120 a day, failure to thrive. The list goes on and on. It was very challenging to the point where some of the individuals in the medical community had suggested maybe we institutionalize him or even move towards foster care, which was not an option for us because we believed that having him within the family and being with his siblings and grandparents would make all the difference in the world. And when Willamette ESD came along, that's where things really started to change, because there were individuals there that could give us some insight to things that we weren't prepared for at all, and also a reality check that this was not going to be easy, and it's not going to change overnight, but these are the things that you can do from a parenting standpoint, but also from a PT, OT, and speech standpoint, made a huge impact, because the bottom line is that things started to happen day one, essentially, where that foundation, that key time for Charlie to start building that confidence, those wins that he can have. Cognitively, Charlie is very sharp. Essentially, he's a 2.5-year-old that mentally can do things that a 3.5-year-old can, but his body is like a 3-month-old, so he's essentially trapped there. But the fact is that he's found these wins. He knows that he can do these things. And where we are today, based on the input of Willamette ESD, is that Charlie is now starting to take food orally. Charlie is now learning to drive a motorized wheelchair. Charlie is trying to sip water. Charlie still is tube-fed, but he's making strides that people never thought that he could make. But it's based on what was taking place at home and starting that foundation early, and that's really where Willamette ESD has come in and made such a difference for Charlie, but really for our family, because they helped his siblings understand how to play with Charlie and how the play can actually become therapy, which would help him grow and take things to another level. So I would ask that if there was any way that the funding could continue with ESD, it has paid off for our family, and I'm sure with the families here in this hearing room, that they'll have the same type of stories, but the impact is being recognized on the local level, and it's been recognized in the Hoppe household. So I thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Hi, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. My name is Christy Reese, and I live in Gresham, Oregon. I'm the parent of this little boy, who is almost 5.
You want to lift that up on the ledge so we can see him all the way? Thank you.
And he is currently enrolled in the Early Childhood Special Education Program in Multnomah County. And I'm also the Projects Coordinator for Family and Community Together. Dennis was born almost 5 years ago, and the day after he was born, we were told he had Down syndrome. We had no experience with disability, and we didn't know what that would mean for our family. We stumbled on information about early intervention, and when he was 2 months old, he was enrolled. We didn't really know why, what it was, but we thought it was what we were supposed to do. Nancy was our teacher's name, and she visited our home twice a month. I say our teacher because though she was there for Dennis, she provided support to us as well. We thrived on information, and Nancy would give us that information. She guided us through the process of writing his IFSP, an individualized family service plan. She gave me information on a local parent group, and she answered questions and made suggestions. In the beginning, while we were learning about Down syndrome, she took the lead in our visits. But over the first year, as we became empowered in our own journey, we became more of a team. She began to be less hands-on with our son and more of our consultant. And the information she gave us and the connection to the parent group was invaluable to us. Since the fall of 2007, our son has attended a community preschool because we wanted him in typical settings. And through ECSC, the Early Childhood Special Education, we have Mary Beth, our teacher who works with families who have children in community settings. She attends our son's school about once a week for observation, and she provides support or assistance to the preschool teacher. He has thrived in this environment. Not only through the work I do, but in my own family, we've become aware of the stresses on the capacity in the early childhood program. I've heard from those who work in the program about their cases, their huge increases in caseloads. And one day recently, Mary Beth apologized for not getting back to me because she had had 8 visits in a day to do. I know there's no way she can spend 30 or more minutes at each visit. In October, we met to add speech therapy to the services our son was receiving. And because of their schedules and the demands on their time, he just started to receive services this week. I asked the speech pathologist what a realistic expectation would be for service, and she told me twice a month. Our son has a communication disorder that was caused because of some hearing issues, and that is not nearly enough. Even as we were learning about our child's disability, we were aware that early intervention would not be enough to meet our family's needs. We devoted time to research. We bought our own library of books, bought our own library of signing time DVDs to help our son with communication. We have provided private speech therapy, and we found and pay for his preschool. His needs have been minor, and so his services have been limited. I know now that I could have advocated for more services, but in a system as depleted as this, I didn't believe it would be beneficial. My husband and I made a decision that we would provide whatever he needed, and that even though our resources are not endless, we have done that. We are lucky because our insurance covers speech therapy, and about 3 visits a month after insurance costs us $81. We have been able to do that with our budget, but I know that many families don't have that option or those resources. Our son's success today is because of a huge support network. That includes early intervention and early childhood special education, but also our family and our friends. But not every family has that network of support, so I ask you to please consider that any reductions to this important mandate negatively impacts families and children. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Whitney Trost, and I'm a mother of 6 children. I live in Tualatin, Oregon, and I live in the Tiger Tualatin School District in Washington County. My youngest child, Christopher, is 6 years old and experiences a disability. We found out that Christopher had Down syndrome when he was 2 months old, and we were immediately referred to the early intervention service coordinator. We were so starved for connections and any help we could get in to know how to help our child be successful and what steps we needed to take early on so that we could ensure that Christopher could be included with his typical peers and thrive. We were surprised to find that most families feel unprepared and overwhelmed and by what it takes to raise a child with a disability. My son attended a class that was 1 day a week in the early intervention program. There were families with children in the class who had to travel several cities for a 45-minute to an hour session. The class had several kids in it that and there never seemed to be enough facilitators to go around. I would ask for resources that I could utilize outside the classroom, but many were given, but the information was often outdated.
In addition, I was not given proper training on how to use pieces of equipment to their fullest advantage. Furthermore, many insurance companies do not cover the cost of outside therapies. My insurance does not provide coverage for any, and a single session for a therapy can be up to $200. Therefore, for many families, one of the only places that any necessary services can, like speech therapy, physical therapy, or occupational therapy, can be acquired is through the early intervention program. While in early intervention program, I felt like the learning specialists were trying with what they had, but time was always limited and equipment could be borrowed, but only for a short amount of time due to the high demand and low supply. If the funds allotted for early intervention were not always at risk, families could be assured access to training and services and have the ability to advocate for their own children in the formative years. Those children will grow and develop and become more independent, which in turn means a lot less money to support them down the road. Each year my son went to early intervention, it seemed like less and less was offered. I have felt all along that the decision makers' opinions of early intervention program is that it is a last minute thought and that not important enough to really make it a priority. This was obvious by the fact that each year the classroom that we would meet in would change to a new location. It was always moved to a farther away school, to a temporary structure somewhere on a campus, because the original room was needed for something deemed more important. Many families had to travel far to come to these facilities for a class that lasted only an hour. I felt that the limited help we got was always a watered-down version of what it could be, but the constant threat of losing funds weighed heavy on the facilitators, and action was limited because of lack of space, lack of employees, and lack of funds. The work that is done for children that experience delay in the early years has proven to enormously improve their ability to be more independent, work at a more meaningful jobs, and as well as learn to advocate for themselves. It is a huge loss to society if we do not support these families and their children who experience a delay of any kind. There is a cost in the beginning, but a relatively small investment up front, and will save money in the long run. Give a man a fish and he will eat for a day. Teach a man to fish and he will never go hungry. We as a society will be making a huge mistake at the detriment of all children in the early intervention program if we continue to cut an already limited budget. We have come so far from being forced to place children with developmental disabilities in institutions. These families want to take care of their children. They want to learn how to advocate. They want to have their children be citizens in their own general education classrooms, but they need help and guidance and knowledge and the support to do this. Each child deserves and has the right to be able to access whatever services they need to help them be successful and productive in the future. Thank you.
Thank you all very much for sharing your family's stories with us and for being such great advocates for your kids. They will all be well served by your commitment to them. And what I've heard from each of you is just that commitment to give them what they need and to be resourceful in finding that. And that's so important. Are there questions for this panel? Thank you all very much. Our next panel is... Part of the last name is erased. Kathy Ashley Strong and Laura Dahiti?
Dale?
Yeah.
That's good.
That sounds good.
Nice shape.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kathy Mihailescu. I live in Washington County with my two boys, Sam, who's 7, and Robbie, who's 5. I'm here to ask you to preserve funding for early intervention and early childhood special education. My son, Robbie, is a great kid, and I wish everyone could know him the way I do. But by the time he was 2, I began to realize that there was something different about him. He fell all the time. He couldn't use his hands the way other kids did. He couldn't hold toys, really. He couldn't scribble with a crayon. But worst of all, we couldn't understand a single thing he said, despite his best efforts. We were desperate to help him. I made calls, looked into speech therapy, but our insurance didn't cover it, and I couldn't get a job because his needs were just too intense. We were barely able to make ends meet. It was only at that point that I found out about early intervention. He qualified, of course, and to my consternation, not having had any experience with this before, the first question the speech therapist asked was not, how can we fix him, but how can we help him to communicate? That first communication board, I don't know if you guys know what that is. It's like a laminated piece of paper with Velcro. It was the most amazing thing I've ever seen. I mean, it was to see him use it for the first time, it was like this incredible sense of power on his part. For the first time, he could communicate his wants and needs without tantrums, without us guessing over and over. At that point, everything began to change. Up to that point, before early intervention, our whole family was under stress. My marriage suffered. I felt scared and alone. Our older son couldn't understand what was going on, and he was angry and had behavior problems. Our family members thought we were just bad parents and sent us videos of Super Nanny, you know, as if we just, you know, made him straighten up, Robbie would just be fixed instantly, and of course that wasn't the case. Those first communication tools that we were given, sign language instruction, the communication board, it gave him just this tremendous boost of confidence that we were able to build on to get him to the next step and the next step. Early intervention was truly the lifeline that helped our family out of a dark and difficult time. They connected me to resources like free clinics, support groups, training opportunities. For the first time in a long time, I felt prepared to be Robbie's mom. Today, with our crumbling economy, there are even more families who are struggling to make ends meet. At the Head Start agency where I work, 14% of our children receive early intervention services, services that our teachers already consider inadequate. Employment among families in our program has dropped 30% within the last year, and that number is growing. What will happen to these children and families, many of whom bear the burden of not just disability, but unemployment and poverty, if early intervention services are cut? How much can a family take before they fall apart? The social and human cost of cutting early intervention and early childhood special education is incalculable. It will have an irrevocable effect on that we will all be paying for years to come. I understand times are tough and we all have to make hard choices, but I urge you to preserve funding for this critical program. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello. My name is Ashley Strong, and my daughter, Ava Elizabeth, has received services through Willamette ESD here in Salem. Ava was born profoundly deaf. She has a bilateral hearing loss, so her natural hearing starts at about 90 decibels. If you think of a motorcycle starting up right next to your ear, for Ava that would be a whisper. When she was 3 months old, we found out that she was deaf. It was actually 10 days before Christmas. And it wasn't something that anyone in our family had. Excuse me.
You're doing really well.
It wasn't something that anyone in our family had anticipated, which is very common. 90% of deaf kids are born to hearing parents. So we felt very lost. We didn't know what to do, where to turn. And when the early intervention program came into our lives, it was a huge turning point for our family. We were able to have someone come into our home and show us different activities and things that we could do with Ava to build her language skills, which first started with sign language. And a huge part of it was the in-home care was able to take the resources that we already had available to our family and use them in different ways that were beneficial to Ava. Our early interventionist has been there with us the entire way. We...
I thought that was...
Thank you. I always get very emotional talking about this. It definitely, it goes really deep for us. So we, as a family, made the choice to have Ava fitted with cochlear implants. So now at the age of 3, she has bilateral cochlear implants. And because of that, she is now speaking, she's singing, she's listening to music, she's talking in her sleep and talking back. So it's been wonderful. No one really ever thought that we would actually have a day where we would ask her to be quiet and stop talking. It's a really amazing thing. And without the early intervention services, we never would have achieved that. They have just been absolutely crucial to Ava's speech and language development. Had she not had these services early on, she entering kindergarten would have been delayed years. At the point that she is now, she is only a few months behind kids her age who have natural hearing. So it has just been absolutely incredible. And the people that we have worked with are so dedicated to their jobs. They take money out of their own pocket to provide materials. They really go above and beyond. And they've really been there not just to provide services for Ava, but to provide support for our family and guidance in helping us make decisions and also connecting us within the community to other members that in that are in similar situations as we are, which has been wonderful. So thank you for your time and for peering through the chairs. I really do appreciate it. And just would like to reiterate the fact that this is such an amazing program, and it's changing kids' lives throughout the entire state. And it would be really sad to see that go away or be cut back. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Representative Gelter and committee members, thank you for allowing
me. Can you move the microphone a little closer, and that way we can capture you forever?
He's going to be interested.
Yeah.
Thank you for allowing me to be here today to present. On May 8th, 2005, my husband and I welcomed twin boys, who are in this room today, and you're hearing quite vocally, into our hearts and home via an open adoption, bringing home two healthy, beautiful boys was simply pure joy for us. We enjoyed each moment. However, knowing the boys had been exposed to drugs in utero, we were very mindful of developmentally appropriate milestones. At 2 years, it was evident that Ethan and Jackson had language delays. They loved to babble, but we weren't hearing the customary words mama and dada. We brought this up with our pediatrician at the 2-year wellness visit, and she referred us to Easy Cares. Not long after we started with Easy Cares, my world of thinking my children had a mild language delay was thrown to the wayside. On February 14th of 2008, a day that was supposed to be sweet and fun-filled, our precious son Ethan, who's sitting back there, was diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder. Our hearts were very heavy. And so began our journey to not let autism define our son. God has blessed us with a bright, incredibly sweet little boy who loves cars, reading books, running outdoors, and whose smile and laughter can just light up a room. I still have high hopes that Ethan will one day be able to read and enjoy school like other children his age. It has now been a year since Ethan's diagnosis, and quite frankly, it's been a roller coaster of emotions. 1 year ago, my husband and I did not know if our son would be verbal. Amazingly, Ethan has made tremendous strides. He's now saying 3 and 4 spontaneous words. Granted, we would like for him to say, I want choo-choo at 2 p.m. rather than 2 a.m., but we'll take his middle-of-the-night request. He's made tremendous strides in his verbal communication skills, yet we know we have many more milestones to reach. As a parent of special needs child, you want the moon for your child, but sadly, it's not always attainable. The American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, the Surgeon General, and the National Academy of Sciences all recommend early intervention for children with autism. Research suggests 25 to 40 hours of behavior therapy each week for children with autism. When Ethan was 2, he received 3 hours of school a week, coupled with once-a-month home visits. This hardly equates to the recommended 25 to 40 hours. When we received the diagnosis, it was also recommended that Ethan receive occupational therapy once a week. Our insurance will only cover up to 32 visits of either occupational therapy or speech therapy, not both, and only after we've met a $3,000 deductible. We are now paying out of pocket for supplemental therapy, but with trying economic times, I'll be honest, it's been a financial hardship for our family, and we don't know how long we'll be able to pursue this. Again, you want the moon, but it's not always attainable. Last September, Ethan started attending a child's garden, which is Easy Care's specialized preschool for children with autism.
He attends the school for 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, and I'm pleased with the one-on-one education support he is receiving from a team of autism specialists and teaching aides. However, 15 hours still doesn't compare to the recommended 25 to 40 hours. I still want, and probably always will, more for my children.
Yeah.
Now, I know the theory is Ethan receives supplemental therapy at home with his parents, but I must confess I don't subscribe to this theory. First and foremost, I am Ethan's mother. I'm not an autism specialist, occupational therapist, or speech pathologist. I have not received specialized training in any of these fields. My role is to play with, nurture, and love my child like no other. Of course, I can incorporate tips and tricks I've learned along the way, but I'm not well-versed in discrete child training or pivotal response training, nor am I an expert in adaptive communication systems or gross and fine motor skills. I cannot begin to express how appreciative I am of the early intervention and early childhood special education services we receive from EC Cares. Both Ethan and Jackson, who's right here, continue to make steady progress with the team of professionals they have working with him. While our house was once filled with the sounds of nonsensical baby babble, we now hear the constant chimes of, "No, that's mine, and you go away." Both Ethan and Jackson's voices are now being heard loud and clear.
I need one.
The earlier for children is just one piece of the picture. I feel EC Cares also provides me and other parents like me with much-needed guidance and education. I've benefited tremendously from the workshops and conferences I attended with topics ranging from toilet training, which is something I'm still wondering if I'm ever going to survive, and how to implement communication and social interaction with my child. I've also benefited from the support of other EC Cares parents who are walking in similar shoes as mine. Every other week, I attend a parent support group facilitated by an EC Cares mental health specialist. There's a group of regulars who attend, and I get so much out of these meetings. The sense of camaraderie is wonderful, and I'm uplifted when I am able to share my children's achievements and cry over their tribulations with other people who just naturally get it. No one can tell me what the future holds for Ethan, or for that matter, Jackson. I've learned, however, to rejoice in the milestones Ethan and Jackson achieve at their own sweet pace. Through EC Cares, I've learned to appreciate Ethan is not slow. He simply has a different learning strategy from other children his age. And he may one day be able to read and attend school with other children his age. Honestly, I'm a bit nervous about life for my children after leaving the nurturing nest at EC Cares. But just like my children, I hope my voice, too, will grow stronger and louder with time so that I can ensure my children's educational needs are met. Thank you for allowing me to share my story with you today. As you begin your fiscal planning next year, it's my sincere hope you remember my beautiful boys and the tremendous strides they are making as a result of the amazing early intervention they're receiving today.
Thank you, and thank you all so much. I know it is. Yes.
I do have one question. I'm sorry, ma'am, in the middle.
Ashley.
Yeah. I apologize. You said your daughter had bilateral cochlear implants?
Yeah, she has bilateral cochlear.
When were those?
Yeah, she had her first implant just before she turned a year old, and she actually received her second implant this last fall. It was activated at the end of September.
Because in 2007, there was a bill about bilateral cochlear implants.
To pay for both
because one wasn't sufficient.
Which is the case. With the first implant, Ava was able to really make huge strides with her language development. She started speaking, but she had no sort of directional hearing. Noise was just noise to her. She couldn't really tell where it was coming from. Now that she has both implants, she's able to turn her head, hear sounds from side to side, which is not just great for her, it's also a safety issue. So taking all of those things into consideration, I mean, it's been just absolutely wonderful for her. She loves them. She calls them her buttons. So.
Thank you. Are there other questions for this panel? Thank you all. Oh, yes, Representative Parker. I was just teasing you.
Yeah, you do that.
Thank you. Thanks for being here. We have some significant challenges, as you know, but your fierce passion and love will be remembered. So thanks.
Thank you.
Mama.
Any other questions?
Okay, say goodbye.
This panel? Thank you. Thank you all very much for coming and sharing your stories. We have one left.
Hello. Good job.
Good job.
And we have one more person. I'm sorry that I put you on a panel all by yourself. Mickey Hill.
I don't think she's alone.
I think she has a guest who's coming with her. Oh, no, please bring her. That's fine.
They're sitting out there.
Oh, okay.
But, hi.
Hello, welcome.
Oh, thank you so much.
So if you just state your name for the record. And
my name is Mickey Hill, and I'm from Eugene, Oregon. And I am a single mother of a six-year-old little girl, Rihanna, who was in the stroller here earlier. We receive services through EC Cares. Our story began when I tried for 8 years to have a child, and we started to go down that path finally of fertility when we got that exciting moment of we don't need to go to the consultation, we got a positive test. And so we were thrilled with the fact that we were going to have this child, and everything went great. I had the easiest pregnancy, things were wonderful, tests turned out positive. Until she turned breech at 35 weeks, which I should have known she was quite headstrong then. I went in to have her turned, and things didn't go so well, and I ended up having an emergency C-section. And to this day, I don't know if her issues are actually from the turning process or if there's some unknown issue that's there. She didn't appear to have many problems at first, and slowly, she started missing milestones. By 12 months, she wasn't crawling yet, and by 18 months, she wasn't pulling to a stand, and language was coming very, very slowly. We were recommended by our pediatrician to have an evaluation done, which I had no clue what that even meant at the time and what my world was about to become. I had, at 20 months, she was 20 months old, and it was in February of 2004 when Judy Newman actually was the first person to do her evaluation. The child that's here today, if she were here and you could see her, is much different than the child that received services from EC Cares. My days when she was mad would consist of scratching and kicking and biting, and I didn't understand her behaviors at all. She would plug her ears when things got too loud or when motions started going too quickly. And when anyone came to the door, it was just constant screaming. So grocery shopping and life was outside the home was not really a possibility. She has come so far, and I believe it's because of EC Cares and the foundation that we built upon for her. She still has no diagnosis. We've gone down the path of possibly autistic, but thankfully she's actually become very social, and they say it's impossible for her to actually be autistic, even though she presents certain things that actually look like autism. She's been quite a puzzle. She was really hard for the team members to work with because she didn't want to be touched or even looked at. She wouldn't be in the room with them, but I was lucky enough to receive home visits, which has been an incredible process for our family to receive services in the home. She had here she comes. She had tight heel cords, which was part of the reason why she wasn't able to come to a stand.
Okay, but Mama's going to speak right now, okay?
All right. And she went through two rounds of Botox injections in her legs and afterwards being casted and has had physical therapy for a long period of time. She has received occupational therapy services and speech therapy services. And as you can see today, she is walking completely unassisted. We've gone through the process of a walker and process of braces, and she has surpassed all of that.
Hi.
Oh, I lost my place. I know, that's from Mom.
I got Best Buy. I can spray.
Are you at the Capitol today talking?
I can spell still because it's high tighter.
I know, the Capitol, I know. Rihanna has worked through the EC Cares program. and moved on to Marlene at the Early Education Program, and she has now just started in the Life Skills Program through the 4J School District and Lane ESD. As you can see, she is walking independently, and her social skills have bloomed. She, her academics are really just skyrocketing this year. It's absolutely been amazing. And she's actually learning to do sight reading, and language has been the most important part. I am here today not as a person who is currently receiving services from early intervention. I'm here because I do believe that that beginning basis is the most critical and crucial point in time to receive services. And it may appear that early intervention is about the kids because that's the part that we're working so hard on and that it's all about the children and getting their services needed. But what I received as a parent was so important. The days when I just needed somebody to help me through the hair-pulling moments and the crying and the grief and all the sadness that I had for a long period of time, and the women that I have worked with have become actual friends of mine now that we're no longer receiving services. That's how close and important they've become in my life. I don't think I could ever repay EC Cares for what they've given us, our family. I still have days when I don't know what the future's going to hold for her. And I have learned through EC Cares to look at her individualness, her uniqueness, and her absolute wonderful personality and learn to appreciate that, and she brings me joy every day. And so I'm just here requesting that early intervention continue on because it is such an amazing and important process in the family's life. And so thank you to Judy Newman for all that EC Cares has provided to our family, and I thank all of you today for allowing me to have a voice here and to say something that possibly may benefit another family down the road. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mickey. Are there any quick questions? All right. Thank you very much, Mickey. And with that, I'm going to close the informational hearing on early intervention and early childhood special education. And I'm opening a hearing on services to children with visual impairments. And Maureen, Casey, I'm going to invite you up first. We're running pretty far behind schedule at this point, and we have a lot of students and others that are here. So I'm going to ask you to be extraordinarily brief because I know we can get you back. And I apologize for that in advance. But we've got six students after you, and I want to make sure we hear from them all.
Representative Gelson, members of the committee, there are only two things that you need to know. I'm Maureen Casey, and that's not one of the two. I'm Maureen Casey. I'm the superintendent of Willamette ESD.
Thank you.
Currently one of the eight regional contractors. And in terms of a framework, and then you're right, I'm turning everything over to the students because they will convey to you the level of services and the importance of those services much better than I could. It was 1983 that the Legislative Assembly actually created regional programs. And there was a study in the 1981 legislature that actually looked at addressing the needs from parents across the state who had children who were deaf or hard of hearing or visually impaired and blind, who asked for services in their local communities to allow their students to access the public school system. So the service delivery model that the State Department of Education put together addressed access and equity to services no matter where parents lived, cost efficiencies, and recruitment of the staff. So right now, the map before you shows the eight regional contractors. Seven of those contractors are ESDs, and one is Portland Public School. You asked us to focus specifically on services for students who are visually impaired, and so I will end by saying, as of December, we were serving in those eight regional program areas 859 children from birth through 21 who have vision impairments. And now I'll turn it over to the students and parents who came today, and if you have time at the end and questions, I'm more than happy to come back.
Maureen, I do have one quick question for you. Do you know what knowing that regional programs serve more than just kids with visual impairments, do you know what the total budget is for regional programs?
Representative Gill, through members of the chair, members of the committee, in terms of the total budget, if you what we get from the State Department of Education is approximately $8,045 per child with a vision impairment, and approximately $9,315 to serve students who are deaf or hard of hearing. Now, those are the funds that the State Department provides to help districts with what they call the excess costs. The districts are our partners in providing these services. The districts are ultimately responsible, as the resident district, for the education of those students, birth to five. It's the ESD contractors who serve as the local service provider, and those districts are responsible for the remainder of those costs affiliated with education.
Great. Thank you very much. Representative Kopp?
Thank you, Chair. And just for clarification, and it's neither, what age group are we talking about? Children birth to age 20?
Birth to 21, correct?
Okay. And so then the question, Dr. Casey, is so then you only get just that, excuse me, it's that small amount from age birth to five, and then when the educational component kicks in at kindergarten, then the education part comes from the school district?
The K-12 part, the school district has the primary responsibility for providing those services. Birth to five, the primary education program is the responsibility of those eight contractors, and then regional specialized services, teachers of the deaf and hard of hearing, physical therapy, occupational therapy for children who meet the eligibility criteria are provided through the regional programs as support services.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I'm going to have us be really quick so we can get to the students. And so we've got Representative Harker, then Representative Mauer, then Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for this information. This is a little bit of the information that I would like to collect. Is there a site to go for all of these, the financial questions, the number of kids being served around the state, etc., or should we contact you directly with inquiries like that?
Representative Gelser, Representative Harker, I believe the State Department of Education is doing their presentations next week, and they will provide the overview in terms of financial budgets for both. And then you certainly can contact us. The State Department, Nancy Latini, will be sharing information, and she will work with us if you require additional follow-up information that you would like from the field.
Thank you.
And those are going to the Ways and Means Sub, but I'm sure that we can work with the good Representative Comp to get that information.
Yes, absolutely.
From her esteemed committee. Representative Mauer?
Madam Chair, my question has to do is low-incidence disabilities,
yes,
and autism is, and how that's defined, and how low incidence is funded versus others. And so I don't expect an answer.
We'll get that information for you too. Thank you. Representative Roblin?
And mine was along Representative Comp's conversation. That is that when they get into the K-12 system, it's in the weighting formula, and the district gets that money, which they can use however they are to provide services in the local community. Is that correct?
Representative Gelser, Representative Roland, that is accurate. And the number of these students, as you know, their needs far exceed that second weight that goes to special education.
But besides that, for these kids, there's this other amount of money that you will continue to get as a regional provider to help the districts help do their stuff.
Thank you, Representative Roland. That's part of the reason why we're here today. We are counting on you to get us.
Are there any further questions for Dr. Casey? No, thank you, and thank you for your patience with being truncated.
Not
very nice of you.
No problem.
Thank you. All right, next we have Ryan McBee, Zebediah Rodriguez, and Jill Hickenlooper. And if I've mispronounced anyone's name, I'm very sorry. I do that often. Is Ryan?
I'm
here. Oh, okay. Oh, great. Sorry, I didn't see you.
Sorry, I see you again.
Gotcha. And Ryan, while you're sitting down, is Zebediah Rodriguez in the room somewhere? Yes, and you can start moving forward, as well as Jill Hickenlooper. You can all come forward at the same time. And Ryan, you can go ahead and start.
Good afternoon, Chairwoman Gelser,
members of the House Education Committee. My name is Ryan McBee, and I'm a junior at Franklin High School in Portland. I'm also a member of the Multnomah Youth Commission. I come before you today to share with you my experiences as a visually impaired student in the Portland Public School District. Since my first day of school, I've always had a teacher of the visually impaired, TVI for short, at my side. A TVI is a person that brails or, depending on the student, puts the work in large print for the visually impaired student. Vision teachers provide the tools for visually impaired and blind students to do their work as independently as possible. I have always had a mobility instructor from the Columbia Regional Program to teach me how to get around Portland. I started out with small tasks, crossing the streets, walking from my school to my home, and currently I am using the TriMet bus system and MAX system to get around Portland. Thanks to my past mobility instructors, last summer I had a job in downtown Portland. I got myself to and from work each day using TriMet. My mobility instructors have made me an accomplished, independent traveler. If given an address in the Portland metro area, I could and would be able to successfully plan a bus route and arrive safely at my destination. I'm a mainstream visually impaired student and have been since day one of kindergarten. I take the same classes as my peers, and in some classes, am a grade or two ahead of my peers. In my freshman year, I took honors geometry, a traditional sophomore class. Geometry, as you know, is a visual subject, but thanks to my vision teacher, I had both large print and braille diagrams. Also, in my freshman year, I took a cooking class at Franklin High School. My vision teacher worked closely with the classroom teacher to get the recipes brailled, the measuring instruments marked in braille, and the burners and ovens marked with braille writing. Since having this class adapted for me, I have used the same adaptations at home, and am now able to cook for myself and others. Currently, I'm taking 7 classes, which is a full schedule at Franklin High School. My classes include pre-calc, chemistry, AP English, Spanish 7-8, and mock trial. My vision teacher only attends pre-calc with me. I attend my other 6 classes on my own, while in my other 6 classes, my vision teacher is failing my schoolwork. My vision teacher, Barbara Hannawalt, has gotten the art of teaching down to perfection, giving me the tools of education, but at the same time, making sure I'm as independent as possible. She communicates with all my teachers on a professional basis at least 3 times a week. This allows me to work independently in the classroom and interact with my peers. Because of the tools that the Columbia Regional Program has provided, I have been able to experience a normal and successful education. Columbia Regional Program has provided me and other students with an arsenal of technology and adaptive equipment. While other kids were learning how to read and write in print, I was learning how to do this, how to read and write in print in braille, reading and writing both in print and braille. Learning braille takes time and patience for both the student and the teacher. It took me 3 years just to learn the basics of braille. I also had to learn how to set up mathematical equations in braille, and then I started learning the braille contractions. In 7th grade, I started taking Spanish class. It took me about 2 weeks to learn the letters of the Spanish Braille code. I had also learned the Nemeth Braille code for math and science. Along with my learning of the Braille codes, I was taught how to use current technology for visually impaired people. Currently, I use a Braille note, which is a computer-like device. I take notes on my own and write all my schoolwork on this device. I print out my work for my teachers, and the printed copies that you all have was made on the Braille note and printed off. I also use a talking dictionary where you type in the word and it looks the word up for you. Perhaps my favorite piece of equipment from the Columbia Regional Program that the Columbia Regional Program has provided me is a CCTV. My CCTV is a TV screen that is connected to a camera which you can point to an object and zoom in for a close-up image. I use this device in my math class. I point the camera at the overhead and watch what the teacher writes. By having the CCTV, I'm able to see what other people can see, except that instead of seeing the information on the overhead screen, I see it on the screen in front of me on the CCTV. I also have a computer at school equipped with ZoomText software and computer screen enlargement. Last October, I received the Portland Citizens Disability Advocacy Community Award. This award was for advocacy in making a difference in the disabled community through youth achievement. I shared this award not only with my family, but two of my vision teachers and my first grade teacher, all three of whom were in the audience at my personal request, because I never would achieve this honor without them. Thank you all for allowing me the opportunity to testify before you today. I want you to know that I want to have a successful career in the future. The Columbia Regional Program has provided and is continuing to provide me with the necessary skills, equipment, and support to help me reach this goal. Please do not deprive any other visually impaired youth of this goal. Do not cut the funding. Provide visually impaired youth the tools they need to be successful in life. Thank you for listening, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Ryan. That was incredible testimony, and I really appreciate having the Braille testimony as well. Many members of the committee got a chance to see a lot of the technology that you talked about earlier this week on a field trip.
Madam Chair?
Yes,
I might point out we even understand what a contraction is.
Oh, you do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So thank you, Ryan. We appreciate that.
Oh, great.
Are there other questions for Ryan? Representative Dimbro.
I do have a question. Thank you, Madam Chair. Ryan, have you ever done one of the summer programs at the Oregon School for the Blind?
No. Are you referring to the Summer Work Employment Program?
I'm not sure. I think the Oregon School for the Blind sometimes has special short-term programs bringing together visually impaired kids from around the state. And I've heard it's a great program.
I haven't attended the program in Salem, but I have attended a couple different programs through the Portland Commission for the Blind. They are good programs. I found them to be helpful. You get to talk to people that are experiencing the same situation. You know, everybody's kind of on the same level. And it's a great way to kind of share ideas for what works, what doesn't work.
Thank you.
Great, thank you.
Are there further questions? Representative Harker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for being here. You're obviously a very bright and dedicated young man. We could maybe use some help figuring out these budget issues at some point. Could contact you about that, okay?
All right,
thanks.
Any further questions for Ryan? Thank you, Ryan. Thanks for your patience sitting through a long hearing. I think next to you on the dais is this... Jill?
Yes.
Hickenlooper.
Yes.
Great. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Okay. My name is Jill Hickenlooper. I'm from Jefferson, Oregon. And I have everything in here, so I'm just going to read it.
Is that okay? Right? That's perfect.
Okay. This is my daughter, Joy. Joy is our middle child and is now 16 years old. We live just down the road in Jefferson, where my husband, Ben, and I are self-employed. Joy has a genetic disorder called Rett syndrome. This is apparently random and strikes girls almost exclusively. It causes the brain to be immature. Most girls have seizures and scoliosis, cannot talk, cannot walk, and have a variety of other complications that make living life a challenge. Joy needs assistance to do nearly everything. We feed her, bathe her, move her, and care for her, and she will require a full-time caregiver for her entire life. But she is social. She's trying to talk to you today. Interactive, happy, and she truly is a joy, and we're thankful to have her and be entrusted with her. We are also thankful for the people in our lives and community that support and help us to do our best for her. Our family, our friends, our church, and especially our school and its services are the main sources of assistance for us. Joy is currently enrolled and attending Jefferson Middle School. She rides the bus to and from school and attends a full day. She has a full-time classroom aide to keep her engaged at task and participating in the school environment. Her aide also receives training from OT, PT, and vision specialists. She has a daily routine of therapies that maximize her health in physical, social, and cognitive ways. Other students interact with her, read to her, and they learn to help her. She also attends music class, and we work as a team to accomplish goals that we set together. The family, the teachers, specialists at regional services from Willamette ESD. We meet twice a year to discuss and review these goals. The team is always attentive and responsive to our requests and concerns, and we're thankful to have professionals committed to giving Joy the help and services that she needs to thrive as a person. This also provides us with encouragement and accountability as parents. I didn't realize how important that was, that we don't always like accountability, but it keeps us on task as parents, and we appreciate that. Because they're watching out for Joy, and the odds for her health and happiness greatly improve. And the chances that we succeed as a family in our community are multiplied. Professional support and services help are imperative. We have observed other families with disabled children crumble under the responsibility. We try to attend like Rett syndrome conferences and things, and every year somebody else has had to give up and turn their child over to the state, and it's hard. So, and it is much like having an infant for years on end. They get bigger and harder to move, harder to feed, and harder to change, and harder to find help for. So when do the families get rest? For families in crisis, caring for a child like Joy can be too much to bear. If a parent becomes sick or disabled or laid off or divorced or evicted, caring for a challenging child can be overwhelming. Some parents do turn their children over to the states, and I know that many do consider it, and the cost is high. It does tear families apart, it's expensive, and it's heartbreaking. But with intact and accessible services, families facing additional challenges, as we all do, and can have a chance to hold it together and carry on. It's cheaper, and it works, and it is the right thing to do, and we are very thankful for it. I have considered what it might be like to be in a country or time when the services and help available now do not exist. However, I resist thinking about it for very long because it is so painful. I know people older than myself who recall the time when children like Joy were simply institutionalized. These children were sisters and cousins and daughters. The children lived without families, and families lived without the possibilities special children offer. When I talk to these people, they often, almost always reflect some version of what if we'd had her with us. And the pain that I feel at the thought of this other time is the pain on their face when they tell me about it. Sorry. However, they are also relieved and thankful that now is a different time. That families like ours and schools like ours and communities like ours. Sorry.
You're doing good.
I'm really good at speaking. I never cry.
It's our fault.
Yeah. And communities like ours that have come to welcome and cherish people who are different and sometimes require help exist. And these things make us civilized. So, anyway, I know that you have to face really difficult choices. And thank you for doing your best.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Do you have any
questions?
So I can do it.
I think Representative Maurer has a question. He's making that question sound.
Yeah. It's question position. Madam Chair, I've only been in this a couple years, and it is clearly the most common issue that comes to us as legislators that I've heard about and what I've experienced is issues of Department of Human Services, developmentally disabled, and of course adoption, but developmentally disabled, and my office have worked long and hard to try to address many of these issues, very hard. And I don't think we as a state do enough to try to keep the families together, because, quite frankly, it's just easier from a state perspective to separate the families, put them in an institution. But it's certainly more costly in both treasure and quality of life for both the parent and the child. And we just really need to come up with a better system to for respite care, for support services, because it's best for everybody.
Yeah.
Rather than just the bureaucratic easy way out. So I really
There does seem to be. I lived in Washington for a while, and then and there was more respite, I think, when she was younger, but we haven't had any respite care for 10 years, and fortunately, we have a support system, but I know a lot of families don't. So you're right, there's a gap.
Thank you, Edson of Nauer. Are there further questions for Jill? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming.
And I think sitting right behind you is Zebediah.
Representative Gelzer.
Yes.
We have Hetzi Franco here, and she really needs to go to her school program. She's very worried about her
kids. All right. That's good. Are you Zebediah?
Yes.
Would it be okay if we let Hetzi go first so that she can get to school? And you can stay right where you are.
Okay.
There's room for both of you. So Hetzi, why don't you go first? And if you just start by stating your name once you get settled, that would be great. And thanks for bringing that to our attention. It's always good to do that.
My name is Hetzavel Franco, and I currently attend Chemeketa Community College. I'm a freshman, and this is my second term. I guess it all started when I was 3 years old. I got services from the ESD from 3 years old up until I was 18 when I graduated. The whole entire time I was mainstream, so I attended regular schooling, and I interacted with my peers just as much as everybody else did, and it was very interesting because I'm bilingual. I'm English and Spanish, and my parents we came from Mexico, and so it was very strange trying to learn Braille and English at the same time. While everybody else was learning to write, read and write, print, I was learning to read Braille, English, write Braille, and also learning English, and for the first part of probably a year and a half, maybe two, I had to go with my vision teacher and somebody else who was Spanish speaker so that we could communicate. Otherwise, there just wouldn't be anything done. I managed to learn English, managed to learn Braille, and that didn't really take me very long, probably the most part of 2 years. So by the first grade, I was able to read Braille, and I was using the old-fashioned Perkins Brailler, which was very clunky and very big. And it was very interesting how I didn't realize that I was different in any way, because thanks to the help from the vision teachers and mobility instructors, I was able to move around just like everybody else and do everything just like everybody else did. And then during the fourth grade, I started to my vision teacher, Diane Mitchell, looked into the technology that started advancing and all these things that started to develop and come up. And so I got into the Braille note, just like was mentioned before, and I got into many other devices that I could use to make things a lot simpler. And I didn't have to carry around that big clunky Brailler and make noise. And so I was very impressed because not only did my vision teacher not know about all these things, but after she found out about them, she took time to learn herself so that she, in turn, could teach me. And we were both learning at the same time, which was a very great experience. And I think that my parents also became very, very thankful that these services were available because they themselves are still having a very hard time learning English, and it's very tough at these times with the economic issues that we're all facing. People get laid off and things happen, but because of the services that I was able to receive from the ESD, I was able to go forward, and now I find myself in college. My time flies, and I'm a freshman, and it's very overwhelming, but at the same time, I look back on everything that's happened, and, you know, because of all the services that I received, I was able to go forward and interact and just pretty much be just as normal as everybody else, and I get a lot of recognition from a lot of my friends, and you know, sometimes people don't even realize that yes, I'm blind and I have a cane, because it just becomes so much a part of me that it just blends in and people just forget. And it's great because, you know, you're able to laugh and do things, interact with everybody else just like any other person would, and there's no obstacle thanks to the fact that all these services were provided early on in time, and they, you know, they never disappeared, never once ceased to exist, which I'm just very thankful. A few of the people that I would like to thank are actually in the audience. Mary Reed, who has been just great. The support we get from these people is amazing. Norm Jordan, Susan Duncan, Diane Mitchell, who was my vision teacher from when I was 3 up to the age of 18. And it was just incredible how far I've been able to go with the services that I received, and knowing that, you know, there may be something changing or some of these services may go away is kind of heartbreaking, because a lot of these kids that come in through to our program are very bright kids, and the thing that they need the most is the help and the support, and just that knowing that they can be just like everybody else if they have the right help, and you know, they're not brought to, you know, they're not brought down or anything. Just the services that are there for the people, it's just great. And you know, knowing that they might just have to go away for a while, even for a while, is kind of heartbreaking, because kids like me and kids like with other disabilities, they need these services early on in time, because it just makes them that much more of an impact if they're there early on in time instead of having them disappear and for a while then come back. I mean, I understand the economy is going through some terrible times, and there are some tough decisions to be made, but thanks to the incredible hard work of all these people, I was able to attend regular school the whole time, and I'm now in college, and there's challenges that are going to come up in life, and things happen, but a lot of them are so simple and just can be overcome so quickly, and it's not so easy, but it's possible to overcome things like that if the right people are there to help, with the patients and the right services are there. And so I guess what I came here to say today is that thanks to all these people, I'm going to college and I'm about to major in psychology. As soon as I get my 2 years in this community college, I'll be able to transfer out, and I'll be able to do things just like any other person would. And soon we'll be to a point where I will be probably helping out a lot of the kids that come through this program as part of giving back to the community what I got in the first place. And I'm really, really hoping that things work out and nothing has to change, because a lot of the kids that are in our program now are very, very bright, and all they need is that care, that the same care that I got, the same care that, you know, is so special to a kid that knows that they can do so much and be successful and just be that person that they want to be, other than just, you know, having them be institutionalized or not having that support at all. And I know that I can speak for my mom and dad, and I can speak for them and say that they too are so thankful that the services that I got were provided in early on in time, and they stayed with me until I graduated from regular high school. And I know that if things work out, these services may not need to go away.
Thank you so much,
thank
Hetsy.
You.
Thank you so much. Are there any questions for Hetsy? Great. Thank you so much. Zebediah, thank you for, and am I pronouncing your name right?
Zebediah.
Got it. Sorry about that. So if you'll just state your name for the record, and then you can share your comments with us, please.
Okay, my name is Zebediah Rodriguez, and I'm going to start off by telling you a little background information about me so you have an idea. I'm a Pacific Islander. Well, first of all, I live here in Salem, and I attend West Salem High. I'm a ninth grader. I came to America, 2003, 5-6 years ago. And it's pretty amazing how, you know, how long I came, because, well, first I came here, I didn't know English, I didn't know how to read, you know, I didn't know the alphabet, well, half the alphabet, no, the Braille alphabet, not the regular alphabet. So, it's all because, you know, it's pretty much from these people's help, you know, the vision specialists and all of these programs that they have in service for each and every one of us. And, you know, I'm just going to list off some of the things that they helped me through. Technology. I started from using a note taker called the Braille Light, which I had for quite a long time, until I got to high school, and now I'm starting to use a laptop. Well, I've been using a laptop. And, you know, they're pretty much there for you for, you know, through school. And, I mean, they start so early, you know, they just get involved right away. They even, like, okay, an example of one thing that they helped me with that is kind of a more of a parent, you know, learn in life kind of thing, is tying my shoes. You know, they even, like, taught me how to tie my shoes. And that's how far, you know, far how do I work this? That's how, you know, young I was that they started working with me. You know, one of the first things is tying my shoes. So now I'm using a laptop, you know, I'm in high school, traveling around with the public, you know. So, you know, it's hard to measure, you know, it's hard to thank these, you know, programs and these people that are just there to support you through everything when you're going through high school, when you're going to school, I guess. That's what I'm trying to say. So to, you know, to say the, well, let's just say that these people pretty much kind of set you on your feet, you know, set you on the road that you're going to, you know, take on after you graduate, you know, after college, and then you pretty much is ready to move on in life. And, you know, I just, I just can never thank these people for how much they've done for me. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming today and sharing your testimony. Do we have, we've got two more people. Are there any brief questions? No. Thank you very much. You've helped us learn a lot today. This has been a great hearing. So everyone that's come and offered testimony, thank you so much. Our last two individuals are, oh, I lost my post-it note. It's Tricia and Bob. Ah. Tricia McCready and Bob. And Tricia, would you start first? And we have to leave here by a few minutes before 3 o'clock, so I'm going to have to ask you both to be pretty brief, and I apologize for that.
That's fine. I've got mine all written out, so it'll be quick. My name is... Can I go ahead and start?
Yes, you may.
Okay, thank you. My name is Tricia McCready, and you'll be getting a paper with a couple pictures with my son on it. Caleb is a first grader at Chapman Hill Elementary in West Salem. Caleb was born full term after an uneventful pregnancy. We knew that he might have some issues with hearing because he didn't pass newborn hearing screenings. And after a visit to the Child Development and Rehab Center in Portland, we came to the realization that he had a moderate hearing loss. In the following months, everything snowballed, and we found out that he was born with cerebral palsy, a couple of different brain anomalies, which are on there, on your sheet, and a cortical vision impairment. The fact that he is both vision and hearing impaired makes him, qualifies him as deafblind. And so a lot of the regional services that he gets are both from his hearing and vision specialists. So I've kind of clumped them together here, and I hope that's okay because they're both part of the regional services that he receives. With all that said, Caleb is a vibrant little boy with a lot to offer others. He's very social, loves to be around people. His smile and laugh can easily light up a room, and his determination is very evident to all that know him. Although he has very little spoken language, he is generally able to get his needs met by using gestures and vocalizations. He is also starting to work on using pictures to ask for toys, videos, and other items. Caleb currently receives a number of services from the school district as well as from the Willamette ESD. He receives physical therapy and occupational therapy from the district, and then he also receives vision and hearing services from the ESD. We're excited about the progress Caleb has made since birth, and much of that progress is due to these wonderful people that work with him. I would like to take some time to tell you about Caleb's vision and hearing specialists. They definitely go out of their way and go way beyond what their job descriptions call them to do. They are truly advocates for Caleb, and my husband and I are grateful for them. They work together to make school a learning experience for Caleb. Not only do they take the time to train staff themselves, but they have also advocated for other people to come in and do staff trainings on the deafblind population. And because of this training, changes are being made within the classroom setting to truly make it a place where Caleb can learn. It is the trainings really are teaching the staff how kids with deafblindness have a very, very different learning style than typically developing kids. And the teachers and the assistants are really taking this into consideration and changing Caleb's program. And that is because of the advocacy of his vision and hearing specialists. Our specialists provide curriculum and make modifications and adaptations to meet Caleb's unique needs as a child with deafblindness. Caleb is also provided with equipment that helps him to access a computer. His vision and hearing specialists really take the time to develop the curriculum in the classroom environment that accommodates his needs. The regional program has even provided Caleb an FM system for the classroom. This allows the teachers in the classroom to speak into a microphone, and that information goes wirelessly to his hearing aids so that he can cut out all that background noise and hear what the teacher is saying directly to him. In addition, the ESD conducts all of Caleb's hearing tests either in the mobile unit at school or at the ESD and facilitates in hearing aid repair. To top it all off, our vision and hearing specialists offer parent support. They are always available for phone calls and emails if we have questions or concerns. When they think of a program that is available that Caleb might be interested in, we are given information on that program. In addition, they let us know about trainings that my husband and I might be interested in attending. They also work hard to help us with funding for glasses, hearing aids, batteries, and other equipment that Caleb needs in order to be successful. His vision specialist even got us funding for a laminator, which I know to most of you is like, why would you want a laminator? But Caleb loves books, and this way, instead of using the baby board books, he can have access to books that are more age-appropriate for him, and I also use the laminator to laminate pictures so that he can communicate with us. He can grab a picture that's laminated and hand it to me, and that's his way of telling me that this is what I want. So our regional specialists really work with us to make Caleb's life as fun and functional as possible, and we truly are grateful for those people. Thank you for taking the time to listen to my testimony.
Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Prinivos?
Yeah, Prinivo. Thank you. I'm the grandfather of...
And would you say your name one more time for the
Bob
record?
Bob Prinivo.
Thank you.
Yeah, ST sign. I'm the grandfather of Zane Davis, who currently attends the School for the Blind, and all this testimony I've heard here today, I certainly don't want to undermine ESD and early intervention and all of that. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful thing that's going on out there in the mainstream of schools. But first of all, I wrote an email to my employer, which is a Wildish building company, last fall on the events that happened to us starting in the spring of last year. And I'd like to just read that letter and then give you some background after that. Go as fast as I can. Beginning in the fall of 07, my wife Deb and I started going over to our daughter Jenny's house to help her with our grandson. Zane is now 12 years old and is blind and autistic. He's had behavioral issues his entire life, but as he has grown closer to puberty, these behaviors, coupled with his increased size and strength, made it necessary for two people to handle him. These behaviors included biting, scratching, kicking, headbutting, and pinching. Our daughter also has a 4-year-old son, and it became imperative to protect him and all others around Zane, as well as to protect Zane from himself. He also engaged in self-injury with biting, kicking, and banging his head. At this time, Zane was attending Shasta Middle School in the Bethel School District. The school built a safe room, a padded room, and had at first one-on-one and then two-on-one personnel to control him. By early spring, they said they could no longer keep him or the others around him safe. He was expelled from the school. Our daughter and son-in-law needed to work and could not care for him during the day, so we began to search for placement with professional help for Zane. We were advised to take him to the emergency room and did so on 3 separate occasions.
And I feel so badly about this. I know there's a lot of words. There's another committee that's going to come in and chase us out in about 2.5 minutes.
All right. In a nutshell then, Zane was taken out of the school, and they brought in professionals at his IEP meeting who recommended the university getting involved and got help with his behaviors. We spent 6 months doing restraints and getting his behavior enough under control to where Zane could be accepted into the Oregon School for the Blind. Now, since he was... he's been there for 4 months. His behavior is continuing to improve. He's doing so much better. And when we first took him to the school, and my wife and I, we saw about a 7 years younger version of our grandson Zane there at the school. His name's Omar, already using a cane at that age. And Zane was mainstreamed his whole school career, and he never learned that stuff. His behaviors were too much for the mainstream. And now that he's at the School for the Blind, it's a world of difference. There's a place for him to be with his peers. And so I guess I'm a couple days late on this testimony, but the School for the Blind is who I'm really advocating here. And sorry it takes so long.
Oh, no, that's fine. That's fine. And I'm sorry to cut you off
at the end.
That's okay.
I would ask you all if you have questions, but I know you all have committees to get to. Thank you all so much for coming to share your stories, diversity of experiences. I've learned a lot today, and we'll be talking about all of these things more. Before you walk away, we have to do one thing. I'm closing the informational hearing on services to children with visual impairments. I am opening a... So you're going to go with me on this one for a second. This is a new thing for us. I am opening a work session for the purposes of bill introduction. I am holding over the work session for the purposes of bill introduction for LC number 3605, which you do not currently have in front of you, until Monday, March 2nd. And I am closing the work session for the introduction of committee bills, and the House Committee on Education is adjourned.
All right, you have to have a chance. You know that the organizer is lying.